Thanks for listening to our podcast. We've got more information and additional resources at probe.org/podcast. And be sure to check out our life-changing Summer Mind Games Camp for high school and college students.
How many good reasons can you come up with for celebrating Christmas? Dr. Ray Bolden shows there may be fewer than you think today on Probe.
What do you think of when you hear the word Christmas? Frantic shopping, family traditions, a commemoration of the birth of Jesus, or a combination of all these responses, and maybe more. If you've been living in the United States long, you probably find it difficult to focus on just one without the others. And if you're a Christian, you probably want to focus on the birth of Jesus, but you spend a great deal of your December on shopping and traditions. Then you may finish the season, as it has come to be known, feeling guilty because you didn't focus on Jesus as the reason for the season. You may even want to ask if the season is really necessary, because you're exhausted, broke, and relieved when it's over for another year. So we want to ask, is Christmas necessary? In order to address this question, we'll focus first on a history of the celebration and its accompanying customs. Then we'll concentrate on whether economics, traditions, or theology make it necessary. The very early church has not left us with any indication that Christmas was a part of their yearly calendar. The Christmas celebration appeared comparatively late in church history, and it appeared as a result of a change in the ways Christians dealt with their surrounding culture. In order to see the progression of this change, it will be helpful if we consider early pagan festivals that were eventually transformed by the church. Some scholars assert that the earliest precursor of the Christmas celebration can be found within a Persian religion that influenced Roman life. One of the great festivals of ancient Rome was related to the winter solstice, celebrated on December 25th as the natal day of the unconquerable sun, and tied to the Persian religion of Mithraism, one of Christianity's early rivals. The church took over this day to turn the attention of Christians from the old heathen festival to the celebration of the Sun of Righteousness. Actually, the Christmas festival was probably the Christian transformation or regeneration of a series of kindred heathen festivals, which were kept in Rome in the month of December. In commemoration of the golden age of universal freedom and equality, and in honor of the unconquered sun, and which were great holidays, especially for slaves and children. Our contemporary struggle with how to react to Halloween may be similar to the struggle the early church had with Christmas. In particular, they had to decide if they should and would celebrate the birth of Christ. Then the question was, when would this celebration take place? The answers are instructive for us even today, and we'll look at those answers tomorrow.
This has been Probe with your host, Dr. Ray Bolden. Jerry Solomon wrote this script, Is Christmas Really Necessary? To download your free copy, go to probe.org. For all of us at Probe Ministries, I'm Greg Wheatley. May you have a wondrous and blessed Christmas.
We're addressing the implications of Christmas this week and began yesterday with an historical overview of the struggle in the early church to regenerate pagan festivals to a Christian theme that will continue today. Church historian Philip Schaff describes the regeneration of heathen festivals in light of the cultural changes that began to affect the church. Had the Christmas festival, he said, arisen in the period of the persecution, its derivation from these pagan festivals would have been refuted by the then reigning abhorrence of everything heathen. But in the Nicene age, this rigidness of opposition between the church and the world was in a great measure softened by the general conversion of the heathen. Besides, there lurked in those pagan festivals themselves, in spite of all their sensual abuses, a deep meaning and an adaptation to a real want. They might be called unconscious prophecies of the Christmas feast. Frank Gabeline informs us that before Christmas was recognized in the West, another festival was prominent among Christians in the East. He said the earliest reference to December 25th as a date for the Nativity occurs in the Philokalian calendar, which refers to its Roman observance in AD 336. But recognition of December 25th in the West had been preceded by that of another date, January 6th in the East, when Epiphany was celebrated first in relation to the baptism of Jesus in the River Jordan, and later in relation to the coming of the wise men or magi to worship the infant Jesus. So, from the era of Constantine onward, Christmas was gradually included in Western culture. By the time of the Reformation, most leaders, including Martin Luther, were for the abolition of all feast days except Sunday. But the long habits of the people were against such a radical reform. During Cromwell's time in 17th century England, Christmas was banned by Parliament. and in old New England, the celebration of Christmas was officially forbidden. Now, of course, almost a quarter of each year is devoted to the celebration of Christmas in American culture. And as we will see, a variety of customs emphasize many facets of the season. Should this history make us uneasy? Should we consider disbanding the Christmas season? Obviously, some have answered yes to those questions in the past and present. But perhaps the wiser response is to give heed to the long traditions of the church and decide if those traditions have a legitimate end. Then we're challenged to decide if we're to isolate ourselves from our culture, become like our culture, or transform our culture. At the present time, it appears that we should reevaluate what it may mean to transform the Christmas season for the glory of God. The Christmas season includes many customs we take for granted. Where, when, and how did these customs come to have a place in the Christmas celebration? Their origination probably will surprise you. The merriment and giving of gifts, especially to children, may reflect the Roman Saturnalia. During this festival, the Romans honored the god of agriculture by engaging in much eating, drinking, visiting, mass reveling, and notorious celebrations on the streets. Courts closed and no one was convicted of a crime. Gambling was legal. Slaves dressed as their masters and were served by them. A mock king was chosen. Gifts were exchanged, at first simple wax candles or clay dolls. Romans trimmed trees with trinkets and toys during the Saturnalia and put candles on them to indicate the sun's return to earth. Druids honored Odin by tying golden apples and other offerings to tree branches. In the 8th century, St. Boniface purportedly dedicated the fir tree to the Holy Child as a counter to the sacred oak of Odin. However, Martin Luther gets credit for the tree we are more familiar with. The Germans placed fruit, gilded nuts, gingerbread, paper roses, and glass balls on their trees. The Poles placed stars and angels. The Czechs made ornaments of painted eggshells. The first Christmas hymns were written in the 5th century. Originally composed in Latin, they contained primarily theological topics. Carols, songs with more human personal subjects, appeared in the 1200s. During the Middle Ages, people incorporated drama and plays into the celebration of Christmas. Carols became an integral part of these reenactments. After the plays, carolers strolled down the street singing, thus the birth of street caroling. A popular medieval feast was that of St. Nicholas of Myra on December 6th, when the saint was believed to visit children with admonitions and gifts in preparation for the gift of the Christ child at Christmas. Through the Dutch, the tradition of St. Nicholas was brought to America in their colony of New Amsterdam, or New York. Over the years, the American Santa developed many of the secular characteristics of the British Santa, Father Christmas, including entering a house with a chimney and stuffing stockings hung near the chimney. This idea came from an old Norse legend. But the American Santa became better defined in the 1800s. Clement Moore in 1822 first described Santa in a fur-trimmed suit leading a sleigh pulled by reindeer in his poem, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas." Now that we've scanned the history and customs of Christmas, can we conclude that any of it is necessary in our time? Tomorrow we'll consider economics and traditions as we attempt to answer this question. Is Christmas necessary economically? C.S. Lewis, in his brusque, reasonable manner, gives us reasons to consider the question of the economic necessity of Christmas. He wrote, "Three things go by the name of Christmas. One is a religious festival. This is important and obligatory for Christians, but as it can be of no interest to anyone else, I shall naturally say no more about it here. The second is a popular holiday, an occasion for merrymaking and hospitality. But the third thing called Christmas is unfortunately everyone's business. I mean, of course, the commercial racket." Lewis then goes on to make the following statements about the commercial racket. 1. It gives on the whole much more pain than pleasure. 2. Most of it is involuntary. 3. Things are given as presents which no mortal ever bought for himself. And 4. It's a nuisance. Such reflection leaves us with a challenge. If we want to de-emphasize the commercial side of Christmas, how do we do it without upsetting the economy? There seems to be no immediate answer to the dilemma the Christian faces while living in this country. I'm reminded of the slow eradication of slavery from the early church. If slavery had been eliminated immediately, it would have created chaos in the social and economic fabric. Thus, there was a patient change as the church influenced the culture around it. Maybe that process can serve as a model for us. 2. Is Christmas necessary traditionally? Most of us live with traditions. There are national traditions, family traditions, religious traditions, sports traditions, military traditions, etc., that affect all of our lives. It seems that traditions are very much a part of what it means to be human. The Christmas season, of course, is full of traditions. When we begin to focus on Christmas at the end of each year, it usually means that we begin to give attention to the reestablishment of things passed from the previous generation to ours. And, of course, it's sad that many dread Christmas because the traditions that were a part of their past cannot be restored since those who shared the traditions are no longer here to share them. So is Christmas necessary traditionally? In order to answer this, I want to offer three comments. First, Christmas traditions can be life-enhancing or stifling portions of our lives. It's up to us to decide which they will be. Second, traditions that bring family and friends together should be positive events. The positive nature of them is up to us. Third, traditions that point to the truth of the Incarnation are reminders of God's glorious provision for us. The way we construct our traditions will either lead us towards or away from this truth. As we close our week-long discussion of the necessity of Christmas, we want to discuss if Christmas is necessary historically or theologically. Of all our questions, this is the only one that has a definite affirmative answer. Without the Incarnation, there is no hope, and Christmas would be given over completely to economics and traditions devoid of Christ. Let's consider what probably is the major fallacy of the Christmas season when Christ is not considered. That is, we attempt to concoct happiness and meaning without substance. Christmas without the historical birth of Jesus in space and time and the theological implications of that birth leave us grasping for something that cannot be obtained. But some level of the implications of that birth can be grasped. Let's reawaken to the awesome presence of God in human flesh. To pass through the Christmas season without thoughtful contemplation of the wonder that God with us is shameful. The eternal being who knows everything and who created the whole universe became not only a man, but before that a baby, and before that a fetus inside a woman's body. If you want to get the hang of it, think how you would like it to become a slug or a crab. C.S. Lewis contributes a memorable illustration of the Incarnation as he considers what it means to assert that God descended to us. One may think of a diver, first reducing himself to nakedness, then glancing in midair, then gone with a splash, vanished, rushing down through green and warm water into black and cold water, down through increasing pressure into the death-like region of ooze and slime and old decay, then up again, back to color and light, his lungs almost bursting, till suddenly he breaks surface again, holding in his hand the dripping, precious thing that he went down to recover. He and it are both colored now, that they have come up into the light. Down below, where it lay colorless in the dark, he lost his color too. May we break the surface of our views of Christmas so that we can recover the precious thing that truly is Christmas, celebration of the birth of Jesus the Savior. No aspect of the contemporary celebration of Christmas is necessary in an absolute sense. But there is a theological necessity that cannot be altered. If God had not become flesh, there would be no hope for mankind. There would be no birth of Christ, no death on our behalf, and no resurrection from death to life. Praise God, he did humble himself and became as a man.